Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, supporting the Farm Progress Show August 30th through September 1st in Decatur, Illinois. ADM, resourceful by nature.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. This is a broadcasting service of the College of Communications on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. My name's Todd Gleason. I work for University of Illinois Extension. We're coming to you today live from the Farm Progress Show, the 2005 edition. This afternoon, three guests will join us here on the stage at the University of Illinois Purdue University tent to talk about the changing food chain. And those guests are Ken Parnell, former vice president of Walmart, Peter Goldsmith, who is an ag economist at the University of Illinois, and Tom Reardon, ag economist from Michigan State University. We'll get on to the discussion very quickly this morning. Peter, I'd like you to open with some comments to begin with. Tell me exactly what a food chain might be.
Yeah, what we're thinking about and looking at is how food moves from production, from farms, through processors, food manufacturers, and how consumers interact with that food, whether it be retail, restaurants. And this process is a very dynamic sort of chain that has made some dramatic changes with globalization. And so how we receive our food as consumers is very different than maybe how our grandparents receive their food.
And do you have opening comments about how this has changed and your research that you'd like to discuss very quickly?
Yeah, I think one of the most important things is how farmers around the globe and agribusinesses are interacting with food manufacturers and consumers. No longer is the food chain bounded by borders, where the producer, the farmer, would be delivering food directly to consumers in his own region, state, or country. We're now supplied globally. Retailers and manufacturers procure, buy food from many different suppliers. So this creates tremendous opportunities for consumers to access markets globally, and also creates a lot of competition, which is good for prices and makes producers and manufacturers more competitive, more innovative. So it creates a lot of dynamics.
Peter Goldsmith is an ag economist at the University of Illinois. Tom Reardon is an ag economist at Michigan State University, joins us here on stage at the Farm Progress Show. And your expertise happens to be in Asia, China, a little bit in Latin America, but it's in a unique area. Can you tell me what that is and the supermarkets and how you've studied that in the last few years?
Thank you, Todd. My work focuses on the extremely rapid rise of supermarkets in Asia, Latin America, and Central and Eastern Europe that are working in exports and in foreign direct investment in other countries. Right now, the main export target market for American farmers is about 1 billion consumers, mainly in North America, a little bit in South America, mainly in Western Europe and in Japan. My work focuses on the emerging markets, which are in Asia outside of Japan, Latin America, and Central and Eastern Europe, which I believe are the fastest growing food market in the world, and over the next 20 years will eclipse in importance the food markets that we're currently exporting to. When you think about the size of that market, we're thinking about, let's say, in Asia, Latin America, and Central and Eastern Europe, 4 to 5 billion people, of which 1 billion are middle class consumers. Until very recently, there wasn't a lot of interest in targeting that market as exporters from the United States, because it was felt that those markets were poor markets, so maybe there wasn't as much attention on the fact that you could add a 1 billion middle class consumers to the 1 billion you already have. And there was an assumption that those markets were dominated by backward marketing chains. For example, mom and pop shops, open air markets, very traditional wholesalers. Our work shows that in the past 5 years only, and at most 10 years, there's been a complete revolution in the marketing systems of those countries with a very rapid rise of supermarkets. I'll give you just two examples to end. One is that in 1990 in Latin America, about 5% of the food went through supermarkets. Today, about 50%, which means that the dispersed middle-class consumers that were difficult to target as exporters from the United States become knit together by supermarkets. In China alone, you have a $100 billion supermarket industry today. In 1990, the figure was zero, okay, and that's growing at 30% a year. They're buying about $70 billion worth of food products every year going through supermarkets. So the modernization of retail is driving basic changes in the food economy, which is translating into completely changed markets for American export products.
Ken Parnell is with us today as well. Ken is with Walmart, was with Walmart. He was former vice president, now is with Parnell and Leighton as a consulting firm, retired from Walmart. Ken, you have some opening comments about proteins and meats and your experience with Walmart and what you're thinking is happening with the food chain?
We see an ever-changing food chain, particularly on the protein side. If we look back in history, and we look back to the 1960s, we had boxed beef as we know it, and chill-packed chickens, pre-wrapped chickens that was introduced in like 1968. And it took us from 1968 until 1999 to start moving into case-ready meat products as we see it today. And we see case-ready meat products really in the future of the protein business. First of all, because of the quality. You've got consistency. You've got product that's produced in USDA manufacturing plants. In addition to that, we know we see a global change. We see a change in the U.S. We see the housewives that's out working today. If we look back at the food industry a number of years ago, sales always at retail always outpaced the fast food and the restaurant business. For the first time in history, they're running about neck and neck, about $400 billion a year. And we see that restaurant and fast food business continue to grow. So as producers, we've got to look at both sides of that business and see how, as producers, as farmers, we can meet that customer need. And again, when we look back and we talk about any of the farm business, I think one thing that we really have to take in consideration is our end user, our customer. What does our customer want today, and what is that change that we see? And as the other panelists talked about earlier, we are a global community now, and to export and import product, we're really going to see a lot of changes in the future.
Ken, in meats and commodities in general, and you referred to customers and farmers and producers having customers, generally speaking, they don't think too much about customers. Did Walmart, in your experience, think of farmers as a supplier, or was there somebody between them that they thought of as the place that they were procuring meats? So was the supplier actually an Excel or another firm, a meat processing firm?
I think if we looked at the past, that we've seen the businesses that was very segregated. As an example, you had the farmer or the livestock producer, and they dealt only with the processor. And then the processor dealt only with the retailer. And the retailer dealt only with the customer. And the other two links had no communication with that customer. And I think what we've seen and what we'll see in the future is I think you'll see everyone kind of holding hands and say, what do we have to do to get the right deliverable to the customer? What do we have to do as an industry to make sure that the farmer survives, makes a great living, that the processor makes an acceptable product, and that the retailer makes a product where they can put that product out on the shelf at a very great cost? And then working together, the three groups, whether it's transportation or production needs, and I think in the future, as we see commodities today, we'll see a tremendous amount of change in the future. I think we'll see a number of retailers, and we're seeing it today, that will go out and contract products a year or two in advance so that the farmer, they know how much they're going to need to produce for the processor. They know how much to produce for that retailer. And the retailer knows that they've got that product coming, and they've got to put it out on the shelf and sell that amount of product.
Ken Parnell is a former vice president of Walmart. Peter Goldsmith, what you just heard from him, does that make sense in the kind of modeling and the way you think about the marketplace and how it's changing and what farmers can or should do to reach out deeper into the chain, whether that all the way, be way all the way to the table or further up that chain to maybe the retailer?
Yeah, I think what it makes total sense. It's really the reality of the food business today, and producers, farmers have to find partners that have carry into the marketplace, who are global marketers, who are successful brand managers, that they can link up with. It's very hard for an individual farmer to have that kind of carry, create that kind of value globally alone. And so we find much more relationship building and relationships develop between producers who are supplying, let's say, the pork or the beef, working with larger firms or working amongst themselves as a co-op to try to get some carry, some size into the marketplace to really serve consumers. And it's much more difficult now alone to market through a spot market because the prices just aren't there. So working with buyers is now essential, and what the supplier gets, what the farmer gets, is a customer, a retailer, or a processor who has access to the marketplace. And so that's a very, very valuable and important relationship.
So, go ahead, Ken.
To add on to what Peter says, I think we have to look back at the past and then look what's happened recently, and then look into the future. If we will walk through a retail grocery store today and just make a list, particularly for these folks who probably are a little older, of the things that you had when you were in high school or the things that you were using, and go back today and look at what you have in your home today that you didn't have. And I look at how fast we have to change. And I'm gonna talk about two items very briefly, and one being lettuce and one being carrots. If we look back 15 years ago at the lettuce producers, we sold lettuce in one form, and that was lettuce by the head. And someone got the bright idea that they was going to put it in packages. Now, did that hurt or help the lettuce producer? It helped them tremendously. Instead of having one SKU of lettuce out there, there's probably 50 different varieties or ways that you can buy that lettuce. If we look at the carrot business years ago, how did we buy carrots? We bought a great big old stick of carrot that we really didn't know how to use at the retail or the customer level. And now what do we have out there? We've got these little small carrots that we see. They're packed in lunches. They're used on trays. Again, we have to be flexible and be ready to change when that customer's ready for a new, different, exciting product. Maybe the same base product like the head of lettuce. Maybe like the carrot, but we have to be ready to change.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on that in terms of the varieties and the specifications of the retailers, and also reflect on something that Pete said. Retailers in the United States already made the shift 5-10 years ago, if that's right, Ken, toward preferred supplier relationships, moving toward using specialized wholesalers, and really moving beyond public standards for quality of product and safety of product toward using private standards. And what's interesting is that now in the retail market, with the rise of the supermarkets, you're finding that in the export market, you're finding the same kind of shifts, so that if you want to get into those markets, you're going to have to be getting into relationships with the retailers or their specialized, dedicated wholesalers. And also, you're going to be having to meet the private specs of the retailers, which often are beyond the public standards. An example that was given to me by a major Paraguay exporter of meat into Europe, she said that her firm had to meet European public standards for meat quality and safety, And she said that was the first of 10 steps that she had to take. Then she had to look at the private standards and specs of Carrefour and of the British Retailer Association and of the specific chains that she was selling to in Britain that were way beyond the requirements of the public standards in terms of food safety and food quality for the meat. And so adapting and molding your specific product to the requirements of those retailers will be necessary for export just as it's necessary for sales in the domestic market now.
Just for clarification's sake, you mentioned Carrefour. Carrefour is the French-owned grocery store line, and there are several different ones in Europe, but that's an example of what a grocery store chain name might be in Europe. Peter, you talked about Kerry, and I've heard everybody talking about volume here. The question in this case, and I think that's what you meant by Kerry, was the size, the volume, the numbers that would be procured by a retailer, and that the relationship was built in large part, it seems to me, on that volume, the carry. How is it that producers, individual producers who may not have enough animals, who may not have enough commodity, can band together or work together to find themselves that niche where they're large enough to actually attract a Walmart or a Carrefour or another retailer to put something into the marketplace? That seems to be, for the average farmer, the biggest stumbling block for them is to put in together the car lots that they need to supply a retailer.
Yeah, right now we see, and we can use the pork industry here in the Midwest as a good example of three mechanisms that farmers enhance their carry in the marketplace, pork producers, compared to if they just sold them on the spot market. One of the best examples is just kind of northeast of here, a new farmer-owned co-op, Meadowbrook Farm, 200 farmers getting together and hiring a wonderful meat marketer to take their product and shop that product in the marketplace using the latest cutting and processing technology. So these farmers now have some carry as they offer a differentiated product into the marketplace, and they've been very successful. That's one way farmers banding together. A second way, very common in the pork industry, is for packer to own the pigs and contract with farmers to raise the pigs. There's a lot of contract production, less so here in the Midwest, more so outside the Midwest, but this gives a contract producer, again, access to the meat packers' customers and total customer base. And then the third way, very common, much more common here in Illinois, is for independent producers to align themselves with a system that would supply to, say, an XL or a Tyson's IBP or a Smithfield, and they maintain more independence, but it's much more of a coordinated chain. So we see that just using the pork industry as an example, we see how producers are adapting and really getting integrated and working with customers who have a place and can find a place in the market.
That seems to be something that works well and has a roadmap of sorts in the livestock industry, but other commodities, corn, wheat, soybeans for Illinois, don't have that type of chain that they can work with. Is there a way that producers develop those relationships, or a reason that you can take a commodity like corn, and number two yellow corn, for instance, which is the corn that all farmers in particular grow, and are capable of taking a feedstock for livestock and putting that into the chain
there's been great interest to try to see about adding value and creating greater value up with grain, especially corn and bean producers. We just completed a survey of specialty grain activities in the state, and I guess not surprisingly, or on the frustration side, there isn't a lot of value-added activity going on in specialty grains because it's difficult. And the reason it's difficult, say, in grains as opposed to my examples in pork, is the distance from the consumer. Corn, by and large, corn and bean producers, they're supplying industrial markets. They're not supplying consumer markets. So these industrial markets are much more difficult to create a distinct brand space, create a distinct product line. They have much more commodity-like characteristics, and so it's much harder to add service and attributes to corn and beans when there are a lot of corn, commodity corn, and commodity soybeans on the market. It doesn't mean it can't be done, but it explains why it has lagged some of the other commodities in terms of value added and greater integration into the greater food system.
Let's skip out of the grains and the commodity markets and then come back to you, Tom Reardon, and talk about exploring the growing marketplace in China, India, Latin America, how supermarkets have evolved there, and what that means for the U.S. export market for food and agricultural products.
If you think about the Chinese consumer, the average Chinese consumer's income is rising at 10% a year, which is about 5 to 10 times faster than the average income rising in Western Europe or the U.S. Second, that consumer is spending about 50% of his or her income on food versus about 10% of the income of an average American consumer on food. That means that the consumer's interest in food is approximately where the United States consumer was in the 1950s and 1960s, where a lot of the major food firms in the United States really took off, okay, with a lot of diversification of products, etc. Secondly, besides the growing food market, there's the same kind of shift that you saw in the 40s and 50s and 60s in the United States, as women are moving away from the home and into the workplace. There's a very fast growing demand for processed products, convenience products, prepared products, the baking industry, okay, the processed foods industry that requires various kinds of specialty flours and other things, the meat industry, you know, the meat consumption, the fruit and vegetable industry, the dairy industry are all taking off extremely fast. So these consumers, which often an exporter might have the image of as rice eaters, are actually increasing the amount of processed products, meat, fruit, vegetables, and dairy products on their plate extremely fast. And in fact, I would say that the main markets in the world and the main growing markets in the world for those products are going to be in Asia, Latin America, and Central and Eastern Europe in the next 20 years and are starting now. The supermarkets in those regions are acting, I think the main punchline is that they're acting exactly like the supermarkets in the United States acted, let's say in the 70s, 80s, and even now. They want quality, they want product diversity because they're fighting it out among themselves, and so they're looking for that product differentiation that Ken mentioned. They are looking for that now. They're not just looking for a standard product. They also want the same spectrum of products that are available in other countries because they're competing. Third, they're looking for also food safe products and food quality products. So they're demanding more and more of the same kind of quality and safety of product that is being demanded in the United States. Third, going back to Pete's point, to market to those supermarkets, you're more and more shifting away from a spot market where you're just selling to maybe a general commodity exchange, or you're selling to large wholesalers that are very traditional, and more you're getting into direct relationship with those chains. Sometimes the relationship that you have with a chain in the United States might help you to open a door to their operation in China or Mexico or Poland. In some cases, you will have to go and get a direct relationship with a specialized, dedicated wholesaler that handles their product and chooses the preferred suppliers in that country.
Ken, I want to talk more about procurement and maybe distribution in this point. based on commodities. We talked a lot about livestock. It appears that meats will be and proteins will be the growth area, I believe. Is everybody in agreement with that across probably the globe, India, China, and Latin America, that meats will be the growth area? Of course, that has to be the feedstock, corn, and soybeans as a protein meal to put into the livestock. The question then is, does the domestic meat livestock industry increase in the United States? And is that, would that be the preference of a Walmart? Or would the preference of a Walmart be to have the commodities, raw commodities, corn, beans, shipped overseas, for instance, to China, and the livestock be fed and processed there and available in country? Which is easier, do you think, and which is more likely, so that the processed, the end product, which would be the meats, where should that be produced is really the question. Now, there's been some thought over the time that that maybe the livestock industry in this state and certainly around the nation may decline and become more of a domestic only program, and is that what you might see, or Walmart might prefer, that the meats that they get be produced locally? And I'm not sure that it means that it's stamped locally, that for purposes of distribution, it might be easier to get the meats in country than to have to ship it overseas.
Yeah, what I'd like to talk about, you know, is total retail. And U.S. products is not a stranger to foreign markets. We've been exporting products to China for years, mainly poultry lay quarters from U.S. And I think they're going to recognize U.S. products. I think they're going to want both. I think they're going to want both domestic, their homegrown product, but I think there's going to be a tremendous need for export product. Do we have some barriers to cross? I think we do. Are we going to have to get across the traceability issue? We're going to have to get there. Will we get the traceability issue ironed out? It will be here, and we'll be able to get product over there like we need to. But there is a love and a need for U.S. products in most countries. If you go to Japan, you know, they love our product. If you go to China, they love our product. So I think there will be both U.S. products and the domestic products. But you mentioned earlier, go back to one of your earlier statements, about a lot of local products and how do the farmers increase that business. You know, I look at all retailers in the U.S., and for the most part, most retailers do a great job with local items in the community that they're in the community or the state they're in. But I think the opportunity for those producers that's producing and selling products that's normally sold in certain states is to look and see how they can produce enough product and take that product across the U.S. or worldwide. And one item that comes to mind, I think we all are aware of, is an onion item. Who would have ever thought that a Vidalia onion that was a local item sold in one county would become a state item, would become a interstate, a surrounding state item, and then become a national item? And can we do that with other products across the U.S.? I think we can.
You picked up on traceability. It's an area that you're interested in. Some of the listening and viewing audience will not know what traceability in the livestock industry is or how USDA and the U.S. government have been working with that. Frankly, why it is needed. Can you explain that, please?
Well, right now, we cannot ship to Japan and other countries because we can't identify the age of the animals. But there is a lot of work being done by a lot of independent companies, and I think that's probably where it will be done, and I think that's probably where the USDA would like to see it come from, would be from the private sector rather than from the government. And that will be coming. And you know, anytime we look at something like that, the first fear we have is cost. It's cost. But knowledge is powerful. Anytime that we can add value to an item, I go back to the years of the UPC code. And for the older group that's out there, they remembered when we didn't have UPC codes. And when I started in the industry, the thought was from the producers and the suppliers is it can never happen. It's too big a project. But my, what it's done for us in the future. And we're going to have future changes. There's a lot of talk about RFID, radio frequency tracking. It's a huge issue right now. and there's a lot of work being done on it. It will be in the future. It will be in the future of processors, wholesalers, and retailers, and there will be a cost. But the cost will be offset by the learnings and the advantages we have of shipping and flowing and moving product. Again, everything we do should involve that customer. So the better value, the fresher product that we can get the customer, the more product we're going to sell as an industry.
Traceability, of course, in the livestock industry is a hot topic at this point, and traceability means the idea that you can identify at the retailer, potentially all the way through to, if you need to, all the way to the plate, where that meat came from, what farm, what premise, and which plants it went through. So those are some of the things, radio frequencies and ID that may go into, it's just a chip. And I suppose for those who don't know, if you have a pet, sometimes they put a chip in your pet so that you can get it back. They scan the back of your pet and they know who it belongs to. And that's similar to what we're talking about for all livestock across, consumed across the United States or produced in the United States.
And I think the concern, particularly for most producers, is going to be the initial cost. But I think we've got to look back at history and think of every time that we've enhanced the value of the animal or the product we're selling, that we've always had a cost savings. And we'll see the same thing with the traceability. It'll do a lot for us. If I went out there today, and sometimes we get emotional, particularly about the protein business, if I went out there today and I asked the major processor of beef today or whoever, you know, I've got a son getting out of college or a daughter getting out of college, what type of animal do you want me to grow for you? You know, what breed? You know, and sometimes you get that blank look. We'll know that one of these days. We'll be able to rank, the breeds of animal. We do it a lot with the grain today. And will it happen in animals? It will.
Tom Reardon, I want to pick up on the traceability issue, but turn it just slightly. So that when we get into the European market with commodities like corn and soybeans or genetically modified products, while it's open now for the BT corns, it's not necessarily, and the genetically modified soybeans, it's not necessarily the fact that those products, while they're being shipped into the U.S., are actually being used by retailers or processors. And my point, I think, is that it seems to me that in Europe, where the power lies is in the supermarket or the retailer chain, that they have the final say-so on what the specs of a product coming in might be. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there's two examples that really come to mind. One is a recent example where there is a debate, obviously, between the United States and the European community regarding labeling of genetically modified organisms. And a major retailer in England said, and I quote, or pretty closely quote, "We do not care what the outcome of the debate is between the governments. We will require labeling of the GMO products in our stores." Okay, so that even if you were able to come up with a ruling of non-labeling, the supermarkets have the last say, and they're able to say that. The same thing goes with fruit and vegetables and meats. There's a Europe Gap, which is a new private standard of the main retailers in Europe that require certain levels of pesticides, of hormones in fresh products. And regardless of what the European community public standards are for those levels, or regardless of what the public standards are from exporting countries like the United States to Europe, the retailers simply set those standards. And they set them much higher than the public standards. So if you want to sell to them, then you have to meet those standards regardless of what the public standards are. And the fact that they have 80% of the whole European market of 400 million people means that they have the power that's actually, in a sense, greater than government power to impose their particular desires and standards that relate to what they believe their consumer wants.
Yeah, Tom makes just an excellent, excellent point about this modern agri-food system that we're a part of And that's really the shift away from the use of the government standards as the benchmark and moving much more towards private standards and having industry lead government in terms of traceability, food safety, quality. And so it's very important that we realize that this is much more of a private movement, and that relying on government-to-government sorts of negotiations is much less fruitful in terms of its outcome. The industries now, the businesses, are global. They operate in many environments. So they can't, nor is it best strategy, to have a unique quality for each individual country that they may be in. They set a high standard that reaches and extends well beyond a local government standard, so that you would get a high quality product in Brazil, you'd get a high quality product in China, as you would, of course, in the United States. So we're seeing a major shift away from the government as the benchmark, and seeing much more initiative by private firms taking leadership and ensuring safety and quality, traceability, addressing questions of BSE and so forth. And this is a very dynamic and a very good outcome for consumers.
Again, the question comes back at the end of the day: how is it that commodity producers, farmers, access these areas? And maybe one of the ways is some of the work that you've done with Market Maker, which is a website, and you might explain just a bit about that. And is it possible to start small, as with the Vidalia onions, using something like Market Maker, and then to develop the relationships that you might need to put a product into the marketplace? And if you could start with explaining what Market Maker is and how that process might work, that could give farmers, producers access to the larger market.
Right. Market Maker was an initiative that we developed at the University of Illinois that said for suppliers, for farmers to connect with these important leaders of the industry, the retailers, the wholesalers, those people who are interacting with consumers. How do suppliers, farmers talk to them? How do they get to know what product to offer? So we developed using geographic information system technology, a multi-layered database that was available on the web. It's marketmaker.uiuc.edu that provides a supplier, a farmer, anyone who supplies any sort of food product, meat, grain, vegetable, spice, whatever it is, all of the information about retailers and wholesalers in the state of Illinois: who they are, where they are, their size, their location, their telephone number, and aggregates them within a census or a geographic area, a cultural area, an income area, however you want to target your product, so that farmers can now learn and go interact and start with. Very important is to start with the customer, say the retailer or the manufacturer, and then build their supply chain backwards towards their farm. You don't just start with a product and try to push it down the supply chain. You need to understand and interact with the buyer, understand what their needs are, and Market Maker is a website that helps you identify those customers, target them, and start to build your supply chain backwards.
This would be a niche market building process. What kinds of produce might have this helped launch and into what areas over
time? One of the best areas, a couple of areas that were very exciting that have gained some very interesting application using Market Maker. One was a group of beef producers who wanted to market a high quality, a very high quality beef into the Chicago white tablecloth restaurant market. These cow-calf operators were able to pull together, seven of them, identify a packer wholesaler to be part of the system, and they began that whole discussion with learning and visiting white tablecloth restaurants in targeted markets in Chicago. Those conversations between the restaurant and the cow-calf operators led them to put a supply chain together. So they're working backwards, starting with the customer and understanding what their needs are. What are the volumes? What are the cuts? What are the qualities? What are the timing? How many per day? So on and so forth. And then they establish a chain, and it's been very, very successful. So that's one example of the use of market maker to develop a robust supply chain.
Again, the address for that, for those who might be interested in looking at market maker, is marketmaker.uiuc.edu. I believe if you simply type market maker into the website Google, that will come up. UIUC stands for University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign Education. That's one way that producers, farmers, of maybe a commodity, in this case beef, and we're looking to ship a high-end product into a Chicago market area, have access to a niche market. The next question, of course, is how do you get hold of a Walmart, and how big do you have to be, Ken Parnell, in order to attack a retailer and develop a relationship with them for a product, whether that be beef or pork or chicken or some other niche market, not niche market, but some other big, large market that you want to get into.
And you know, you ask how you get a hold of Walmart. I think it's how do you get in touch with retail? And I think sometimes that we're, as growers, producers, processors, we think because we're small, we can't do business. I think every retailer in the United States loves to do business with small suppliers, small producers, small farmers. I know all retailers deal with small producers. As an example, there's some suppliers that make only one item, and they may only put that item in a small geographic area of 100 miles. But it's a store. It's a store of a community for any retailer, and you need to be in that. I know Tom and I was talking about the customer this morning, and again, I'm going to reemphasize that everything we do should revolve around the customer. Tom and I have both made many trips to Chile, and there's a lot of salmon produced in Chile that we don't produce in the U.S. And the first thing they tell you when you go through one of those Chilean salmon plants is, this is the way we produce it. This is not the way we have to produce it. How does your customer want this produced? What size do they want? Do they want it boneless? Do they want it bone in? And again, we talk about the opportunities in the U.S. of doing more business with export markets. Again, we have to look at the customer, produce what they want to produce. If we look at the pork industry today, a great example, their numbers are just growing by leaps and bounds by export. Why is that? We're not producing what we want to produce on the farm particularly. We're producing what that customer wants in the U.S. and what they may want overseas. That's the reason it's such a great item to export.
Ken, we've come to the end of our time. Any closing comments from you about the changing food chain that you'd like to discuss as we finish out our time?
Well, again, we were slow to change from the 60s to the 90s. That's not going to happen in the future. Things are going to change fast. Again, go back home and look and see what you have today that you didn't have in your home 5 years ago. We're going to see the same thing in the food chain.
Ken Parmenel is a former vice president of Walmart. Peter Goldsmith is with us. He's an ag economist at the University of Illinois. Closing comments from you and for producers, commodity producers, and how the chain from their farm gate to the retailer on to the food plate might be changing in the future.
Yeah, I'd just like to add that these dynamics, in one sense, change is difficult, change is new, we need to learn. But there's also just tremendous opportunity. I think some of the things we've described today about growing demand, changing demand, means that food is still has a central place in the way consumers behave. It's an exciting place. There are lots of opportunities out there, lots of opportunity for young people to get into the business. It's just going to be a little different. It's going to be global. It's going to be international. Makes it more exciting. So. Those of us in the food business, it couldn't be more energized and challenged, and lots of technology. It's just a wonderful time to be in the food business.
Thank you very much, Peter. Peter Goldsmith, of course, an ag economist at the University of Illinois. Tom Reardon is an ag economist at Michigan State University. Just a little more than a couple of minutes for you to finish up, and I do want you to go back into, as you close out these final comments, Tom, how retailers overseas have developed how the supermarkets are developing and what you see as the potential export market for agricultural goods from the United States.
As I started in my comments, I want to just come back to the point that in many ways, and this is repeating something that Pete said, we're at a historic moment when we're essentially doubling the size of the world market that American exporters can target, moving from only having really an attainable market of Western Europe, North America, and Japan, with some exports going to other regions over time, to suddenly adding 1 billion middle-class consumers in emerging markets, really the most earth-shaking event in markets faced by American farmers in 50 years. And these are markets that are growing 5 to 10 times faster than our traditional markets, with incomes that are being spent half on food. And a lot of that food is being spent on processed grain products, on meat products, on fruit and vegetables, and on dairy products. And in that case, the question is, what is the way into that market? And the way into that market is the rise of the supermarkets and the fundamental supermarket revolution that's occurring in those emerging markets that in only the past 5 years, and maybe as much as 7 years, has completely changed the nature of those markets, where you go from maybe a share like 5 to 10% of the Asian market or the Latin American market that's dominated by supermarkets, and the rest by small mom-and-pop stores, really what the U.S. was like in 1930, to suddenly fast-forwarding the film in only 5 to 10 years to a situation where you have 50, 60, 70% of the markets in those countries dominated by modern retailers. So they're doing in one decade what the United States did in 7 decades, driven a lot by urbanization, foreign direct investment. And those supermarkets are focused on the same kind of quality, diversity, cost, availability of product, volume, consistency that you face in the U.S. market. So there's suddenly a tremendous market that's been knit together by these supermarkets. And at the same time, that's the good news, the extremely good news for the American farmer. The challenging news is that everybody knows it now, okay, that around the globe, world-class competitors and suppliers from those regions, from Europe, and from other places are leaping onto those markets. So there's a stampede that's about to start to get into those markets. So I think that the strategic moment is now to align oneself. And I think that I want to end with a point that Ken made, which I think is absolutely essential. As I listen to and I travel around the globe listening to exporters targeting the supermarket market and to the processors that are serving the supermarket market, and what I hear over and over again is, what do you want? When do you want it? What do you want? When do you want it? So the obsession of the successful exporter is the customer is always right. Now, that was always true in the domestic U.S. market over the years. But now I believe that the successful exporter will also think the customer is always right and aim at what the supermarket procurement officer wants around the world.
Tom Reardon, thank you very much. Peter Goldsmith and Ken Parnell, thank you for joining us today. We do appreciate it. You've been listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL. My name is Todd Gleason. I work for University of Illinois Extension.
And we are live here at the Farm Progress Show now. That, of course, an archive edition of a program that happened this morning on the stage at the Farm Progress Show, which is in Decatur, Illinois. My name, Todd Gleason, and here are the way the settlements prices came across from the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. In the wheat pit, September futures were up on a high side of 307 and three quarters, a low at $3.75 of a cent, and they settled down 5 3/4 at 301 and a half. December futures 324, the high, the low at 316 and a half. Settlement price at 317 and a half. Grains and oilseeds down at the board on, of course, Katrina and uncertainty about the grain handling capacity of the United States, as railways and certainly Gulfport outload areas for exports have been impacted. 337, the high for the nearby March contract, low at 330 and a half. Settlement price down 5.5 cents for the March wheat. July futures were down off 5 cents at 341 and 3/4 for the July contract in the wheat pit. From the board, September corn today, 204.5 the high, the low at $2 even. Settlement price there at 201.5. They were down to December futures, 220.5 the high, the low at 215. Settlement there at 216.5, down 2 cents in the March contract. Down a penny and a half today, 227.25. The settlement price, the May, or rather July corn at 238.5, down a penny and a half. And September for next year, 244, off a half cent. September oats, 147, a settlement price at 5 higher today, with a high of 147 and a low at 140. September soybean, 603.5, the high, the low at 584.75. Settlement price at 586.75, off 13 cents. November beans today down 12.25, the high at 615, the low at 596.5, and a settlement price down 12.25 at 598.75. The March contract is 629 high, low at 612.5. Settlement at 614.5. They were down 10.75 for today. Bean meal September futures, a 182.40 settlement price, down 220. And the October bean, or rather September bean oil at 22.41 was off 45 cents. Stay with us for the closing market report this afternoon, live from the Farm Progress Show. Now, with the settlement prices from the Mercantile Exchange, we go back to the studios at WILL.
Thank you, Todd. This is Celeste Quinn, and prices today on the Merc, well, livestock prices mostly higher today. September feeder cattle, the high 111.95, the low 111.15, the settlement 111.77.5, that up 17.5. October 110.50, the high 109.67.5, the low, the settlement 110.17.5, that up 10. November feeder cattle 109.50, the high 108.65, the low, the settlement 109.47.5, that up 27.5. August live cattle 83.75, the high 82.20, the low, the settlement 83.25, that up 50. October live cattle 82.95, the high 82.20, the low 82.25, the settlement that down 27.5. October lean hog 65.07.5, today's high, the low 63.60, the settlement 63.70, that down 12.5. December 62.30, the high 61.05, the low 61.55, the settlement, that up 55. February lean hog 62.50, the high 61.70, the low 62.45, the settlement, that up 52.5. April lean hog 60.17.5, the high 59.65, the low, the settlement 60.05, that up 20. February bellies, the high today 82.10, the low 81.05, the settlement 81.07.5, that finished 22.5 lower. Let's take a look now at what's happening on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently up 30 points at 10,443. The NASDAQ up 12 at 2141. The S&P 500 up 5 at 1214.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember.